so happy and really I feel so honored that today I can welcome Dr. Cilla Elworthy to the Conscious Evolution Summit. I'm super excited to have you in this expert field.
Thank you, Priya. I'm very happy to be talking to you.
And I just want to give a brief introduction, and please correct me if I mix up something or forget anything, because you are a 3-times Nobel Peace Prize nominee with the Oxford Research Group. You are the founder of Peace Direct. You are the co-founder of Women Rising, Rising Women, Rising World. And you wrote this amazing book, The Master Plan of Peace, where we learn how to create a world without war. And I'm really thrilled to first of all hear from you. What just brought you into this peace work? What was your inner motivation to basically dedicate your whole life for peace building in our world?
I think I was one of the lucky ones who don't have any choice. Because when I was 13, I was watching a grainy old black and white TV in my parents' living room, and I saw the Soviet tanks crashing into Budapest. This was in 1956. And they were mowing down, killing people not much older than me who were protesting against them. And I was so upset and angry. I rushed upstairs and started packing my suitcase. And my mother came up and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm going to Budapest." I didn't even know where Budapest was. And she said, "What for? What's the matter?" And I said, "Well, there's something so horrible happening there that I have to go." And she said, "Don't be so silly." And I burst into tears. And bless her, she understood. She got it. She understood how important this was to a 13-year-old. And she said, "Listen, you're too young to be any use. And if you'll just unpack your suitcase, I will see to it that you get trained so that you can be useful." Mm-hmm. And she did. She sent me off when I was 16 to work in a holiday home for concentration camp survivors. And from there, I took myself to work with Vietnamese refugees and in Algiers at the end of the Civil War and so on. So it was, my life path led me rather than me leading my life path.
Mm-hmm. And when you now look back, what would you say, what really supported you in building the skills which are needed to be in such powerful fields of conflict and to work really on the edge of our world, of our really wanting to overcome war? What was it?
I think it was fundamentally self-knowledge. And I say that advisedly because I didn't know much about meditation or inner silence before I had a brain disease when I was 30, just after my daughter was born. And I was in a coma for 2 weeks. And when I came to, I had incredibly severe headaches for 6 years. My brain was a fog. And there was one question going round and round and round in my head, and that was, who am I? Who am I? Why am I here? And so not many people were asking those kind of questions in the mid-70s, but I eventually found my way to a person who could really help me, who was a Jungian, and she taught me to look inside, to become an observer of my emotions, all the things which I now recognize are vital to have the presence of mind in a crisis. You know, if something happens, which is very frightening, and if we're overwhelmed by fear or anger, we're not able to be present enough to have the wisdom to know what to do. So it's vital if we want to be doing peace building or peace negotiation, or even preventing war, then we need to have done or be doing a daily practice of inner self-examination of whatever kind. It might be walking in nature, it might be gardening, it might be, but I think it has to be a regular daily practice and slowly build. And also, as you do, work with colleagues, work with in a group, a sangha, as they call it in Buddhism, where people help each other to grow in these difficult areas.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess especially the emotion of anger or fear, I assume is something which can easily be triggered. We all know it from just little conflicts with partners, with colleagues and families. And is there anything particular what you would recommend other than, as you shared, having this ability to be present, to be with it without acting with it? What any specific ways to build this capacity?
Mm-hmm. It sounds silly. It sounds a little bit naive, but the strongest way to resolve a conflict is to listen. Now, if you and I were having an argument, maybe we're part of the same family and it's been going on for years. If I could say to you, would you be willing, that's the key phrase, would you be willing to spend half an hour with me? And first of all, I would ask you to speak for about 5 minutes about how you feel about the conflict. You're not pointing a finger at anybody, but just saying what this does to you. Does it make you sad? Does it make you lose sleep, etc.? And then when you've finished, I will say back to you what I've heard you say, and also the feelings that I detect behind what you've said. And then you can correct me if I'm wrong or I haven't got it clearly. And then we change over and I do the same thing. I speak in the first person about my feelings about the conflict and you listen. And then you feed back to me. And I can guarantee that when that interaction is done, we will have moved from here, which is the brain that says I'm right and she's wrong, to the heart or the belly even that says, oh my goodness, is that how she feels? So it springs from the fact that I think the greatest respect we can pay to anybody is to really, really listen to them. Not thinking about what we're going to say or what's a clever riposte or what's the answer or the solution, but just listening. And I teach this to the global leadership teams of very big corporations. And at first they're quite cynical and shrug and so forth, but after they've practiced for an hour, they begin to instill it in their teams, and it's now, in one company, it's gone down to four levels. It's now at the level of 400 executives. And they say, what you taught us enables us to resolve in 15 minutes what would have taken 4 hours of argument and still not been resolved.
Mm. Very beautiful. Yeah, and for me, it doesn't sound naive at all, because I really believe in simplicity and how you would say in English, just this ordinary sense of what makes sense, you know,
just common sense.
Common sense, that's the word. Yes. But what I also get when I listen to you, Scylla, is that if we would be in a conflict, just maybe we look at two people are being in an argument, maybe it would take really a moment to just stop it and to maybe just separate for a few minutes or an hour, to be able to even invite another person into this different space you just described so beautifully.
Yes, it does need a quiet time. And for example, when I was convening meetings of nuclear weapons policymakers at the highest level of the military and scientists and strategists, and one time I had a team of Chinese, a delegation from China, who came to Oxford and met with British and American policymakers. And we had a public meeting, and it was before real trust had been established. And during the meeting, an argument broke out. It was something to do with fissile materials, I think. And there was, you know, the tension was rising a little bit. The voices were becoming heightened. And so at a certain point, I said, "Gentlemen, we've been listening very intently to these important positions being stated by our colleagues. Now we're just going to take 3 minutes of complete silence and not say anything for 3 minutes and digest what's been said." And somewhat to my amazement, everybody did it, including the audience, closed their eyes and sat there in silence. And when we reconvened, the atmosphere was completely different. It's like...
Yes. Mm-hmm. I just sense it when you share it, and it, I mean, I wasn't present in the actual thing happening, but I still can sense the how it shifts the energy and the quality in the room. Yeah. So, but this also already requires someone being that aware and present to making this invitation to take this break and go into silence.
Yes, and that person has to have a kind of, I would say, an authority, not authoritarian, but authority born of respect, that he or she is respected and respects the audience or the group. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a situation of mutual respect for that to be accepted as a procedure.
And this kind of bridges to subjects I'm also very interested in. This is this subject of leadership, and especially of feminine leadership, because for me, Zilla, you really embody a lot this elder, wise, feminine wisdom. And I'm curious to hear from you. What supports us? And of course, it doesn't only address women, it's also for men. We all have male and female qualities in our field, in our being. So what supports kind of developing this feminine leadership qualities?
Perhaps it's first understanding what comprises feminine intelligence. And by that I mean an intelligence that's available to men as it is to women. This is not a gender issue. But the different components of feminine intelligence are, first of all, listening, like we've just said. Secondly, compassion. And that is the ability to feel for another person or group, but not get immersed in their pain. Somebody told me a very interesting observation about me the other day. She said, "Scylla, you suffer for the people in Syria. You suffer for them." And I said, "That's true." She said, "Don't do that." She said, "There's enough suffering in the world without you adding to it. You know what to do. You've already done a lot to help the situation. Just be content with what you're able to do and heal, but don't get weighed down with the pain there." So compassion is feeling with a group or a person, but not getting immersed, not carrying the pain that they're in, because that's disabling. Compassion always includes action.
And I just want to kind of interfere there, because I find this so delicate and crucial, this point, and I would like to hear from you what enables us to make this distinction and to basically really go into this different inner attitude.
Ah, that's a very, very good question. It's something to do. Let me just examine. Hold on a minute. I think it's easier for those of us who are activists, who like action. Those of us who are very emotional can get soaked up. It's very easy to get soaked up in somebody else's pain, even if it's a child or a family member. But I know, and I think most of us know from experience, that the most useful thing we can do when somebody's in pain is serve them in some way, not get into deep empathy. I'll give you a very obvious example. If you walk past somebody hunched in a sleeping bag on the street and it's raining and they've been out all night and they're in a terrible state, you could look at them, be grasped by your feeling of shame, misery, sadness for them, pain, or you could go to the nearest shop and buy them a sandwich and a hot drink. That's the difference. And it gives me shivers when I say it, because it's common sense. But in a way, swallowing their pain is simply adding to the sum total of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make more sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. And what I also get, kind of, I followed my own question, so to speak. What I just noticed is that when I would have not be so consumed by the pain, what I just recognized that I'm on an energetical inner invisible level, keep staying more expanded in a way, keep staying more open in a way, not so contracted and not so sucked in to a certain emotion. This is just the best way to describe for me how I would distinguish it.
That's exactly how you've described it, is perfect. Because when you're sucked in, like sucked down a vortex, or, you know, a plug hole even, you can't act, you can't do much. Whereas if you expand the situation and say, or even ask the person, what do you most need? How could I serve you? And then you are in service. And service is the highest quality of human maturity.
Yeah. And Scylla, I know that you offer different, this peace talk and an online course which is running, and maybe you might offer it again. What would people expect? How do you support them in building their capacities while you are with them in this journey together?
Well, I do two things. First of all, I wrote a book about 18 months ago called The Business Plan for Peace, as that you referred to earlier. And the whole of the second part of that is examples of what, in quotes, ordinary people can do. For example, if your children are at a primary school and there's bullying in the playground, you could go to the head teacher and say, would you agree if I came into the school for 5 minutes every morning and just did some quietness with the children. You'd have to be confident you could do that. But children love it. If they're quite young, they can lie on the floor and put a cuddly toy on their tummy and watch it go up with the breath when it comes in and out with the breath. So you teach them to breathe and calm themselves. And the result is, well, certainly whenever it's been done here, is that the children are much calmer, they learn much better, and there's less antagonism or bullying in the playground. So that's just one thing. You can take all of these skills into your workplace or your community, and show people how to listen, how to resolve conflicts before they erupt. So there's all that, and there's a toolbox at the end of the book that's got all these exercises spelled out in it. So that's one way. The other way, as you say, is the online course. It's been going now since the International Peace Day last year, the 21st of September, and it will culminate this year on the 21st of September when we're having a very big event for International Peace Day at the Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London. So each episode of the course has been recorded. People can access them online. And each episode tackles one of the issues that I've written about in the book, how to build peace locally, nationally, or even internationally, and what are the skills you need to do that. Because I firmly believe that all of us, every one of us, has the skills to be a peace builder. And it takes a little courage sometimes to stand up for what you believe, especially at work. But there are many simple skills that you can learn. For example, how you take a stand on something that you believe in. Most of us, including myself, I used to kind of cringe a bit when I was a bit frightened of saying something that I knew would be unpopular with my superior. And I would shyly hunch my shoulders and mumble a bit and maybe lower my head. And I learned the hard way that the only way to stand for what I believed was really to stand. So planting the feet firmly on the ground. And that's really important. Plant the feet a little bit apart and then feel the energy rising right up through us until we can connect with the infinite above. And then we're wired, if you like, to be authentic. And that's what I noticed when I worked with Nelson Mandela. He had that incredible authenticity. So his integrity was such you could feel it viscerally. I felt it in my body when I was around him. And you knew that you absolutely could not push him around. You couldn't persuade him something he didn't want to do. You couldn't blackmail him, nothing. Because he was so rooted, so grounded. And I do feel that's a big element of actually a feminine intelligence, to be grounded. We're lucky as women that we have our monthly period and we can be in sync with the moon, but we're also very much in tune with the seasons, as many men are. And so we can amplify that by finding a piece of ground somewhere, a garden or a park, where we can actually take our shoes off and stand on the ground and just feel what the ground has to offer us. Because the earth is there serving us, growing things all around us the whole time. And nature does nothing but serve us, want to help us, give us food, give us shelter, give us beauty. And the more grounded we can be, in the earth and its abundance, the more grateful we are, and that's a great strength.
Thank you that you share that. I really feel the power in it. You really in this physical posture and in this connection with the ground, I really receive that it makes you stronger, but also in a, how to say, in not in a rigid way, just in a very grounded way. Yeah. And another question which just popped up related to that is that sometimes when we are about to take a stand, to take a position, I notice from myself, sometimes there are these little voices in your head. Mm-hmm. How can you dare? You are not an expert. Maybe the others know more. You know, just this thing. What would you recommend? How can we be with that and move it and transform it and shift it?
Oh, it's so common. I think everybody has it. Sometimes when I speak to a large audience in a room, I say, does anybody here have an inner critic? And every hand goes up. Even very successful, top of the rung, civil servants and leaders, business leaders, have what they call the imposter syndrome, meaning one day they're going to find out how little I know. And so we all have that critic. It's part of being human, and it can be decimating. It can tear you apart before you have to make a speech or do whatever you have to do. So what I do, and my inner critic often wakes me up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and so I toss and turn and can't get back to sleep, and eventually I think, okay, I've got to deal with this. So I get up, I make a cup of tea, and I put two cushions, and I sit on one, and the other is for my critic. And I speak first of all to the critic, and I say, why did you wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning? What is it you want me to know? And then I literally go over and sit on the other cushion, and to my amazement, I speak in his voice. And he will carry on with the criticism. He'll say, well, you haven't prepared for tomorrow. You don't know what you're talking about. You're going to make a fool of yourself, blah, blah, blah. So then I come back to my seat and I say, that's really not very helpful, you know. What do you really want me to know? And then I go back to his seat. And eventually he will deliver in a voice that is not mine. He will deliver what I call a gem. It's like a diamond. I see him as a dragon, and he, underneath his claw, he has a diamond. And he wants me to get it, but I have to be in dialogue with him first. I have to hear what he's going to say. And he always has a truth for me, always. So, long story to say that my experience is that it's absolutely necessary to open a discussion, a dialogue with that voice that sits on our shoulder.
Yeah, and basically what you shared, how you interact with this part of in us, with this voice, is basically how you would be in a conflict situation, where you would invite the other party to listen and to share. Yeah,
exactly.
So it's kind of the inner peace building dialogue, so to speak, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that. And it's all part of the basic idea that not to run away what we're frightened of. Because many times we learn as children to kind of go, oh, it's too scary, I'm going to go and put my head under a pillow, or adults go and have an addiction or a drink or whatever. And as long as we do that, the fear, whatever it is in that monster, gets bigger. Mm-hmm. So only thing to do with your personal dragon or your personal demon is to talk to it.
Mm-hmm.
Invite it into a dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And what I also remember from my experience, because for me it was also quite a big step to set up a summit, do it twice. I mean, it's not live, but I know many, many people will listen to it and maybe some agree and don't agree. But what helped me to overcome this shyness and this fear was I just thought, if all these wonderful people from whom I received really beautiful knowledge and teachings would just hide and give their fear or their shyness the authority, I wouldn't have received all of these beautiful gifts. And this kind of also helped me to not be, to listen to it, but not to give it too much authority to run the whole show, so to speak.
That's right. You got it exactly. And that you were following your true path in that learning. And thank you for, because it's a very brave thing to do, to be vulnerable just the way you were and say, you know, it was a bit nerve-wracking for you at first to start these interviews and put them online.
Yeah, absolutely.
Challenge. And thank you for being vulnerable. I think that ability to be vulnerable is a great, great asset. In fact, one of the companies where I've trained their executives, now it's part of their value system that they say, being vulnerable is an asset. It's to be respected and always made room for. I love that. I think it's very, very advanced.
Yeah, very beautiful. I also resonate a lot with it. Thank you for sharing that. And I mean, Scylla, the topic of the conference here is this conscious evolution. And we already shared quite some really foundational skills, this ability to listen, this ability to be present, this ability to stay open when we feel pain, this being vulnerable, taking a stand. And is there anything else? What comes to your mind where you see where we now as a human family are kind of in this challenges? What do you see? What is relevant to become conscious of and to find different ways to move it or to be with it?
I believe every single one of us has a contribution to make to the future. We're all alarmed by what we experience. The world seems to be very violent. It's actually getting less violent, interestingly, in the statistics. But the media makes us feel that everything is crumbling and, you know, it's all doom and fear and anger. And yet, younger people, many of them, are really searching as to what they can do and be. So when they come to me and they say, oh, the world seems to be such a mess, I just feel I don't know what to do. I feel hopeless. And so I say to them, I have three questions for you. The first question is, what breaks your heart? And every one of us has something that breaks our heart. It might be wounded animals. It might be people in Syria. It might be lost children. Trafficking in women, whatever. So identify what breaks your heart. And they do that. And then I say, and what is your best skill? What are you good at? Are you good at social media? Are you good at crowdfunding? Are you good at writing articles and blogs? What are you good at? Can you draw pictures? Can you paint murals? What do you love doing? So they think about their skill. And I say, okay, apply your skill to what breaks your heart, and then tell your friends. And I guarantee that within a couple of weeks, you'll have four or five people gravitating towards you and saying, can I be part of that? And then you'll have a little team, and in a year, you'll be doing things you never, ever dreamed you could do.
Mm.
You and your gang. And you'll get the feeling of belonging and being very useful, which is what we all need. And anybody can do that. Anybody. You know, even people who are living with illness or disability, people who are lonely, anybody can do
this. Yeah, that's very beautiful. And I just also highlight that it's not always just this big, big influential events and projects are relevant. It's really the little things just in front of our door can make already a huge difference.
Exactly. And it's when it really touches the heart, when it's heartbreak, and it's different for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And maybe just because we are already coming close to the end of our time together, I'm just amazed how fast it went. But I would also like to hear from you, what is the relevance of joy and fun and really doing what we like in life? Because sometimes we can kind of be overloaded with there are so serious things to do and a lot of work and emails and connecting and this and that. And I sometimes have the feeling we should not leave this quality and aspect of joy and fun just out.
Absolutely. It's essential, Guria. You're totally right. If we don't have that, the times to really blow the top off our lives and have a creative fest or a lovely dance party or a long walk with a friend in nature or whatever it is that we need to get perspective and just forget about all the things we must and should and ought to do, but just do the thing that really brings us joy. And I, as I get older, I've been a workaholic nearly all my life. So I have to really remind myself to, build into my life joy and, all those things. And I'm very lucky now because I have grandchildren and they keep me very focused on having fun and, digging and reading stories and going on adventures, and that's completely wonderful. And also I now insist every week I have two what I call space days, and those are days when there is nothing in my diary, nothing, so I can wake up, I don't have to get up, get dressed, I don't have to put makeup on, I don't have to be somewhere, I don't have to travel. I need 2 days like that. Those are my joy days. And I always end up those days nourished and stretched. And I usually build quite a lot of exercise into it and seeing friends and playing, just playing.
Mm-hmm. I just heard from one businesswoman that she actually also writes this in her weekly planner so that it's not just happening when there is voluntarily a gap, but she just writes it down, time for a walk or time for sports or time for having a great meal with a friend or something like that. So really that it has the same value as any other tasks and issues.
That's exactly right. And mine's in my official diary and my colleagues know that's my day for myself. And it's lovely. It's really, I don't know, everybody can do that, but I realized I had to do something a bit dramatic to stop getting overtired and worn out. And we're no use to anybody when we're burned out, worn out, miserable, and stressed.
Mm-hmm. And also, as you shared before, when we really, you said, ask yourself what I love to do, where do I have skills? I mean, we could really make a contribution for a shift, for rising an atmosphere, creating more value just in things which we love to do. And this is already then, such a different way to contribute.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's the love and joy that comes more and more into our lives as we're living on our path and walking on our path. Mm. And we know that the soul knows. Your soul knows, my soul knows, everybody's soul knows what the path is. And that's why we need a period of quietness every day just to listen. Okay, am I on the path? Yes. And the soul often has something to say. And it can't say that if we're busy doing emails. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And I want to give you the opportunity to close our conversation with sharing if there is anything in particular what you would like to, or what you need or what you would like to see in the world, or maybe even practical things, so how people could contribute or support your work.
Yes, they could go on our website, which is just called www.thebusinessplanforpeace, and they'll find a lot of details about what we do. One of the things that we'll be building very soon is a worldwide community of people like yourself, like the people that you reach, who all want to make a contribution to peace. But already in the online course that we're doing, every single student of the Business Plan for Peace, I think there's 250 now, is developing his or her own peace project. So I love that however local, however small or big, people are developing their way of building peace in their community or their workplace or in the world. And that makes me so happy and excited. And as we get a little bit better organized, we'll have a community function so people can contact other people who are doing similar things. So if you were working with refugees, you could contact other people in the community who are also working with refugees. If you were offering art classes to people who had disabilities, then you would find somebody else in the community and form your own circle. So that's one. And then the other thing is we do need very badly to raise money. So we're very much open to people doing a bit of crowdfunding for us. You know, if they're running a marathon or doing something where they can raise money, that they do it with the Business Plan for Peace in mind. And then we would be overjoyed to receive anything that they raise, anything, small or large.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And if something comes into your mind in the future after we have recorded our conversation, I'm very happy to share it with our audience, Scylla, just that you know.
Thank you. Well, it'd be lovely if you put our website and contact details after we finished.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking your time to making a gap in your schedule for our conversation, for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, just basically what's really matters in your life with all of us. I thank you so much, Scylla.
Well, I thank you because I've enjoyed it, and I love the way you are and the way the work you're doing, and it's very, very valuable. And the way you communicate and the questions you ask are so much up my street. You know, they're so important in the work that I'm doing. So I'm grateful to you.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure and an honor for me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.